Well, good morning and welcome to Mornings for the Master here on the Gospel Radio Network. I'm your host this morning, Ryan Smithy, right along with Chip Horton.
Hello!
And certainly wish you a good morning. Hope that you have been able to join us already on the network and continue listening indeed throughout the day. And want to remind you of some ongoing events and upcoming events that you have some additional listening opportunities even this week. Focal Point is going on down at San Marcos, Texas, and we are broadcasting those lessons live as well, the main lessons. And so after we finish Mornings for the Master, go back to the homepage and look for the special broadcast link there at the bottom of the screen, and you'll have that choice then. You can listen to the regular programming, or you can tune in and listen to some of the lessons from Focal Point. And so Focal Point's going on through Thursday, Thursday about noon, and then Thursday evening, the 24th Annual Gulf Coast Lectures. And that's Thursday, May 5th through Saturday, May 7th, and they'll be looking at the theme of Christian fellowship. And so if you're anywhere in that South Texas area, certainly encourage you to make it over to Portland this weekend. And then one other event this weekend I think you have there, Chip.
Yeah, coming up this Saturday, May 7th, the ladies are having a Ladies' Day there in Blossom, Texas, up there on good old Highway 82. Becky Blackman's coming to town, and they have sent out this advertisement telling us that she will be speaking to the ladies that day about singing in the rain, which a lot of us have been doing here recently. I know we've had a lot of rain in this area. But they want you to know that registration begins that morning. Again, that is May the 7th at 8:30. So make sure and be there early, because they're going to get things started about 9. There's going to be a continental breakfast that's provided, and then they'll have a luncheon following. And so they have announced this from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. On this Saturday, May the 7th, again, there in Blossom, Texas, Ladies' Day.
All righty. So those are some of the events that we know of anyway. I know much more is going on throughout even Texas, but indeed throughout the world, and I encourage you to be a part of those local events that you can, and even travel to some of these things would certainly be of great benefit to you. But let's get into our study for this morning, and we will be in John chapter 19. If you're following along with us, as I hope you are through the study of the New Testament, we have come now to John 19. And it's interesting to me how much time John spends here at the end of Jesus' life. You have a 21-chapter book here, and much of the detail we've been looking at for seems like almost 2 weeks now has been these last, say, maybe 6 months of Jesus' life. Mm-hmm. But you stop and think, going back to chapter 13, we're in the last days of Jesus' life. Jesus has been preparing his disciples in John 13 through John 17. You have those warnings. You have that he was going to be taken away, that comfort that he gave in John 14, the promise of the comforter that was to come, John 14 through John 16. You have the prayer of Jesus in John 17, both for himself and for those disciples, and even us today, for those that would believe on Jesus through their word. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus has had that compassion. He's shown that love, that he's thinking about other people. And so these last, nine chapters there almost, deal with the very latter end of Jesus' life here. And now as you move into chapters 18 through 21, you're dealing with the betrayal, the trials that Jesus is going through. You're dealing with the crucifixion, the resurrection, the appearance of Jesus to his disciples in those final chapters. And one has well labeled John 13 through John 21, the way of the cross. Mm. And this is Jesus' preparation and leading up to that. And I think it was maybe you, Chip, a week or so ago that had talked about the idea of of how Jesus is constantly looking toward that event. He was leading. I think is the word that you had used there. He was leading. He never was following behind. He never was being pushed to this event. He's leading his disciples, and his face was set to Jerusalem to do the will of the Father. And that's what we see here even this morning in John chapter 19. And so we continue to see the theme of John, as we see that Jesus is indeed the Christ, the Son of the living God, and also the theme of John, not just here in this gospel account, but in all of his epistles, how much he deals with love. And certainly that is on display as Jesus endures these trials and these afflictions, not because he's guilty, but he does it for us. And I tell you, another comment here, that noun form of agape is found some 333 times in the New Testament, and approximately a third of those, some 108, are found in the writings of John. Wow. And so that's how much he focuses even on that theme of love, and we see that here on display as Jesus is giving his life. And we're going to break this chapter down into some groups here, and may take this first chunk and come back and explore it a little further here. But let's go ahead with verse 1 through 16 as we see the kind of the end of the trials here before the cross.
All right. Then Pilate, therefore, took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head. And they put on him a purple robe and said, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they smote him with their hands. Pilate, therefore, went forth again and saith unto them, "Behold, I bring him forth to you, that ye may know that I find no fault in him." Then came Jesus forth, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate saith unto them, "Behold the man." When the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate saith unto them, "Take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." When Pilate, therefore, heard that saying, he was the more afraid, and went again into the judgment hall, and saith unto Jesus, "Whence art thou?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Then saith Pilate unto him, "Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee, and have power to release thee?" Jesus answered, "Thou couldst have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin." And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, "If thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. Whosoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar." When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat in the place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha. And it was the preparation of the Passover, and about the sixth hour. And he saith unto the Jews, "Behold your king." But they cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate saith unto them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Then delivered he him therefore unto them to be crucified, and they took Jesus and led him away.
Okay, we have here about six trials almost that have been counted that Jesus is enduring. This is the final of those. He has gone through the trial before the high priest, the Sanhedrin, that night before. He's already been brought before Pilate. Pilate sent him away to Herod. Now he's come back for this final time before Pilate. And this is all connected back to chapter 18 here in verse 1. Then, that reminds us, these are those events that are following those trials that have already been endured of John 18. And that's one of the things that, Chip, we've talked about at various times as we've looked at these accounts, is how easy it is to read through here and miss what's going on, because the accounts are, the word I keep coming back to is muted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're dealt with very softly. The very fact that these things are happening. But remember, the physical condition that Jesus is already in. He is physically and emotionally wearied. He's already, you know, had that emotional night where he's praying in the garden. He's gone through that hard night where he's been carried around between these various groups. No doubt he's exhausted and hungry and thirsty. And now we open this chapter up, and Pilate is scourging Jesus. And let's not forget that this scourging often happened before the crucifixion, but the very means many wouldn't even live through the scourging. As you take these cords, as it were, and I think you've described this for us before, it would have bone or stone or other things embedded in these leather straps, and you're being beaten with these leather straps. It's tearing at your skin. It's not just bruising. It may start there, but it literally begins to rip and tear apart the flesh. There was a note here that I had never thought about, but you know, as those things wrapped around their bodies, there were some men that would lose eyes and teeth, and certainly their back would just come away torn to shreds. You're bleeding. You're in pain. Every movement that you make at this point is going to be painful. Your innards, as it were, all of your insides, as the skin is ripped apart, is exposed to the air. All of these things are happening, and yet we have that record before us in verse 1. He scourged him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I urge us to be careful not to just read over that and not think much about it, but certainly go back and look at the humiliation and look at the pain that Jesus would already be in by this point. And it's after that, verse 2, they're going to put this crown of thorns on him and this purple robe. And oftentimes, again, I think we look at that and we think, well, there's humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
They were scoffing at him as a king and mocking him. Well, yes, that's a big part of it. But you put a crown of thorns on your head and have somebody beat it down on your head, and those spikes are driving into your skull, and now the blood is running down your head as well, which, if you've ever had a cut or something to that nature on your head, it bleeds profusely.
Yeah.
Not only that, as you've been scourged and somebody puts this purple robe, again, as a sign of mocking, but remember what his back looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Remember how torn up his flesh is, and you put something over a wound that you have and then have it ripped off. This, again, is not just the humiliation or the mocking. There's physical pain that is involved in this ridicule and this abuse. And so they began mocking him and this fake praise, "Hail, King of the Jews," and then hitting him with their hands.
Mm-hmm.
They're continuing in this. This is a man that stands before them in pain, and yet they're continuing in this mocking, in this ridicule. And then Pilate will bring them out. And there's three times within this chapter we're going to find Pilate make a similar statement that begins with "Behold."
Mm-hmm.
Behold, as he brings out Jesus, I bring him forth to you to find that I find no fault in him. You know, Pilate's he's a bit of a puzzling character to me. He is controlled by the crowds. He's doing this to appease them. But how many times is he going to, and I think we noted this in Luke, that he responds, "I find no fault in him." Mm-hmm. And the simple fact, Jesus should have been released right then.
Yeah.
There was no reason to hold him. There was certainly no reason to scourge him. And there definitely was no sense in which he should release him to be crucified here in just a few moments. And so I think there's some degree here. Pilate has Jesus scourged, brings him out to set him before the people and say, behold, look upon this man. This is no king. This is no conqueror. Mm-hmm. He's beaten down. He's worn down. At this point, probably the idea there is he poses no threat. And so I wonder if Pilate hasn't done this to satisfy the crowd, and they'll say, okay, in compassion that they might have left, we'll let him go, and maybe now this will silence him. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's not why Pilate hasn't done this, as he brings him forward and says, I find no fault. Look upon him that is beaten down. Mm. And yet there in verse 6, they would continue crying out, crucify him, crucify him. Mm. Again, this statement that's going to be found in at the end of verse 6, he said, you take him and crucify him. I find no fault in him. Pilate knows they can't. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to be by his order to allow this. But again, stating his innocence, I find no fault in him. And yet the Jew says he needs to die. And we find here their final charge they've kind of set upon here. And it's this this charge of blasphemy. Hmm. He made himself to be the Son of God. This is what they're finally going to kind of reference. And we might go back to Leviticus 24 and verse 16, if you want to reference there. As far as the law of Moses, yes, they had the authority there to stone one who blasphemed the name of Jehovah. And that's what they're referencing here. But, Jesus has indeed identified himself as one equal to the Father. But the fact is, he's not blaspheming. He's telling the truth. Mm-hmm. But they have rejected all of the evidence and everything that he has set before them. And so this is why now they will be calling out for him to be crucified. But now imagine you're Pilate and... I like how one described him. They relate him to one who is blown about by every wind of doctrine, as spoken in Ephesians 4. He goes along with the crowd, and then he sees Jesus, and he says, this man's innocent. He goes back to the crowd. He proclaims their innocence, and they cry out to crucify him. It's like whoever I last saw is the one that I'm listening to. And there would be some fear here. He's claimed to be the Son of God. I might ought to think about what we're doing here. And again, goes back before Jesus, saying that he was afraid here in verse 8, and went in and asked you, who are you? Where are you from? Mm-hmm. But Jesus, rightfully so, has no answer. Not that he has no answer, rather I maybe want to word that as he had no reason to answer.
Right.
Throughout it all, I think one of the things we're reminded of, Jesus was in control. Mm-hmm. Even though it seemed like he was being beaten, even though it seemed like he was weak, we're reminded of a great definition of meekness. Mm-hmm. All the power that he had as the Son of God, and yet he has it under control. There's the great reminders there that Jesus was going to lay down his life, John chapter 10. No man was going to take it from him. And we see that again. As Pilate tries to assert his authority, and it's interesting he tries to assert his authority before Jesus because he's given up his authority. The Jews are in control. He's doing their bidding. He's going to bow to them, and yet he wants to come and appear as an authoritative, powerful man. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't taken that role on. Yeah. If he was, he'd have said, release him, send him home. There's no reason for death, and dismiss this whole case. And yet he comes here and he says, don't you know I have the power to crucify or release you?
And then Jesus speaks up.
Yeah, as it corrects there in verse 11. You wouldn't have any power,
right?
But it's been given you. Again, we have that reminder that... he had been delivered Some have asked exactly here, verse 11, who is Jesus speaking of? Was it Judas that betrayed Jesus that had the greater sin? Was it Caiaphas as the high priest that had delivered him? Was it the Jewish nation as a whole that he's speaking of, those that have delivered me into your hands? In some degree, maybe it's all. Those, they had a responsibility here to their actions, and they have a great sin because they've done this. You know, many argue maybe it's the idea of Caiaphas as the high priest and representative of Israel that he's speaking of, that they've laid these charges, they've trumped them up and brought them here. But the powerful thing to bring away from verse 11 is Jesus is that reminder, he's still in control. And it's by his choice, if you will, that he is, that he's here. As he would say again, you know, he could have called the legions of angels to destroy the world. But instead, he was willing to endure these trials. And so Pilate, then it remarks in verse 12, is seeking again. And again, what we lose here in translation is that idea, again, thankful to those that know more about the Greek than I do, but it's the imperfect active. And it means Pilate would literally keep on seeking for the release of Jesus. He knows the right thing to do, but he doesn't have the backbone to do it. He won't stand up for that which is right. He tries to keep seeking for the release of Jesus, but the Jews would keep on crying out, if you let him go, you're not Caesar's friend. Is Caesar king or not? If that man makes himself Caesar, then he's fighting against Caesar. And yet Jesus has already said back in chapter 18, my kingdom's not of this world. I'm not trying to take over anybody's kingdom, but that's the how they will twist his words. And so Pilate, fearful for his own position, for his popularity, will again bring forth Jesus and set him before this judgment seat. And in a mocking way, bring him forth and say, behold, here is your king. And there is a remark here that this is about the sixth hour. Here is John, who is using that Roman time. We're about 6 o'clock in the morning, and that he's going to bring him forth. This judgment cannot be issued, as I understand it, before 6 in the morning, and so now this final judgment is going to be passed down as he sets him before them and says, "Here's your king." I find this response interesting as well, as they cry out, away with him and crucify him. What, do you want me to crucify your king? And they say, we have no king but Caesar. As I look back at the history of the Jewish people, I find their remark self-condemning, because, again, they are taking God, who ought to have been their king, and replacing him with another. I can't help but think back to the time of Samuel, when the people cried out, we want a king like the nations around us. Even when they're warned what that's going to mean, even when they're warned what's going to happen, they still say, give us a king. And here they're saying, we have no king but Caesar. They're pledging allegiance to an earthly king rather than to the heavenly king, rather than to God that they ought to have been following. And shows their hypocrisy and their apostasy as they turn away from God. And so it ends that Pilate would deliver Jesus unto them to be crucified, and they would take Jesus away at the end of verse 16. And so those things have all happened here at the final hours of this trial. We're sometime a little past 6 in the morning now, and they're preparing to lead Jesus away to be crucified that very morning. And so let's go ahead and look now at verse 17 through 22, and see the time on the cross.
And he, bearing his cross, went forth into a place called the place of a skull, which is called in the Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him and two other with him on either side, and Jesus in the midst. And Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. This title then read many of the Jews, for the place where Jesus was crucified was nigh to the city, and it was written in Hebrew and Greek and Latin. Then said the chief priest of the Jews to Pilate, Write not, the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am King of the Jews. Pilate answered, What I have written, I have written.
Okay, and so this takes us from the judgment hall to Golgotha, to the place of the cross. And John simply mentions here Jesus carried his cross for himself. There's no contradiction here. John just doesn't record the fact that some of the other gospel writers will mention that Simon would help bear that cross. Mm-hmm. But still, Jesus bore his cross. He carried it for himself. Now, he was aided because, again, remember the physical strength that would be drawn out of him, mm-hmm. having already been scourged, having been mocked and beaten, and again, the physical and emotional drain that already had to be in place. And commentator remarks here, John is emphasizing here, I believe, that the love of God manifested in his suffering. It's not that he is misrepresenting. Again, it's that idea that there are different angles, and he's showing here the pain that Jesus would have to endure as he walks this road. And this road, even given the name, the Via Dolorosa, the way of sorrow, as it goes forth from the city of Jerusalem outside to the place called Golgotha. And they're going to reach this place about 9 o'clock in the morning. And so those trials have endured. By the time they have walked here, we see that progression of time. And Jesus is going to be crucified outside of the city, again, in fulfillment of so many Old Testament markings and fulfillment of prophecy, even as the Hebrew writer mentions, for the bodies of those beasts whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned without the camp. Wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered without the gate, Hebrews 13:11-12. And so we see that capital punishment was going to be outside of the city, and this fit those prophetic offerings that were going to be offered through time as well. And so Jesus is brought outside of the city. There he is crucified. John makes mention of the other two, those robbers that were crucified as well, one on each side of Jesus. And fits Isaiah 53:12. He was numbered with the transgressors. That idea there that he took his death among those who were guilty, and yet he was innocent. And again, this muted statement, they crucified him. Mm-hmm. So much more is going on that we don't necessarily see, but again, it would do us well to think about how crucifixion was retained here, but usually only used in the case of the most vicious criminals. It was a thing of humiliation, normally removed of all of their clothing. The soldiers would be the ones that would be recipients of that clothing. Here, you would have this vertical beam that was placed in the ground, and then the horizontal beam that Jesus was carrying, he would be laid down on top of that. His hands would be bound to it, and then the nails driven through his hands. And then that beam would be lifted up into place where he would hang. His feet also would be nailed to the cross. by the spikes, and now he is left suspended in the air, left to hang in physical agony until one had described it, until death mercifully released him from suffering. And it's that idea of excruciating pain so much that now you desire death. But death often came slowly. Sometimes men could hang on the cross for 2 to 3 days. Because here, as I understand it, you remember the physical condition you're in. Your skin is torn. You're beat up already. You're hurting in pain. And now when you hang there on the cross and your body is sagging, it makes it difficult for you to be able to breathe. And so you have to pull yourself up, use all those muscles contracting in your body just to get up a little bit to where you can catch that breath, and then you release it because of the pain that you're in, and you sink back down, and this process would continue repeating. And the whole time that's doing that, you're rubbing your back that's already so sore, and it's dragging along this rough cut beam that is the cross. And I can't imagine that level of intense pain. I've been fortunate in my life to have had relatively few pains and no broken bones or anything of that nature. And so I can't imagine any sort of pain to the degree that he would have been enduring at that time. And not just that, but you add to that the mocking of those that are passing by and wagging their heads and talking of him. And here again, John will make mention of this title. And here would be a placard, if you will, that would be attached to the cross, identifying him and who he was, what he had done. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And I couldn't help but think, what a truth was set out by even before those who were rejecting it.
And by Pilate again.
Pilate.
The truths that he did.
Right, right. Pilate had seen it, but he refused to fully accept it. The Jews had seen it. Again, they rejected it. And yet here's that title. They even want him to change it. No, don't say that he is. Say that he said that he was.
Right.
But no, Pilate says, I have written what I have written. And it was written there in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek, so that all that passed by could read this. And I like a statement someone wrote here. He said, here's Pilate, a coward in the great matter, but he asserts himself in the small. The one thing he really stood up for, he says, no, I've written what I've written.
The placard.
He wouldn't stand up for Jesus and say, he's an innocent man, we're not going to crucify him. But he stood up and said, I've written what I've written.
Yeah.
And there's Jesus upon the cross.
That's got to be, you know, just a form of an insult to these individuals that just pressed his feet to the fire. You know, the authority that he maintains, the power that he has and who he is, and yet he was run over by this mob mentality. And so this is his last ditch effort to, you know, kick him to the curb, as it were. And so this title, he's certainly not going to change it, because as he recognizes in his mind, it's an insult to them. And so, you know, leave it be. It is what it is.
And I think that's what really strikes me here about John's account is how much Pilate really caved in his authority. And yet he still wants to be seen kind of as this authoritative figure. But he's lost that respect because he caved to the will of those that were forcing his hand.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think it's only in John's account that the words Pilate wrote are used. I think the other accounts may say that there was a title placed or there was a placard placed.
Okay.
But I think it was John, I believe, that only used the fact that Pilate wrote it. I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, the way that John uses so many different things that are significant. That just seemed to be one of the small details that was kind of stand out to me.
Right. Very good. Actually, yes, I did have that in some of the notes here. John is the only writer to state that Pilate wrote it. Mm-hmm. And so here's the charge that was given. Well, let's look at Jesus on the cross and verse 23 through 27.
All right. Then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his garments and made four parts, to every soldier a part, and also his coat. Now the coat was without seam, woven from the top throughout. They said therefore among themselves, "Let us not rent it, but cast lots for it, whose it shall be, that the scripture might be fulfilled, which saith, They parted my raiment among them, and for my vesture did they cast lots. These things therefore the soldiers did. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples standing by, whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour that disciple took her unto his own home.
Okay, two important interactions here. First, we see the dividing of Jesus' clothes among the soldiers, again, as was customary. But this tunic, this coat, rather than dividing it as it was without seam, there's some sort of casting of lots, a gambling of some sort to see, well, who's going to be the one that gets it. And you can make reference there to Psalm 22:18 as the Old Testament reference and prophecy that these things were going to happen. And that's one thing I think we can stress here at the end of Jesus' life. You know, some men will try to speak up and say, you know, Jesus just made his life fit the prophecies. But there are so many things that he had no, I hate to word it that way, but I'll say it, he had no control over. And by that I mean, look at his birth. If he was just a man, he had no control or foreknowledge of it, where he was going to be born, when he was going to be born, all of these things that he had no control over. And here at the end of his life, the manner of his death, the events of his death, all of these things were prophesied of, which if he was just a man, there was no control, there was no power to regulate those things. But all of these things were done according to prophecy. And so here they are dividing these things up, even as they've just crucified the very Son of God. And they're focused on the physical things instead of on the physical things or the spiritual things of the cross that are truly important.
And again, you know, notice, you know, one of those things that, again, possibly we glance over, you know, scourge, crucify, and here they stripped him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's for a Jewish male. And again, remember who's standing there, Jewish females, right? And here he is stripped, some have said naked, but maybe just, you know, one simple piece of garment or something. I mean, I don't want to be dogmatic there, but I mean, stripped.
Right.
Ultimately humiliated in front of all of these people. And then if that weren't enough, as you mentioned, you know, the wagging of their heads and the comments that would come alongside of that. But here before your own mother,
right?
You know, we have an opportunity to kind of look back, you know, during Thanksgiving or something, you know, mom walks in on you in the bathroom when, you know, you're whatever, at different times in your life when you have become embarrassed. Nothing matches this. Nothing could match this in front of this crowd. And so just the continued humiliation that we see.
And then this interaction even with his mother, as the remark is, and perhaps that's why part of this is John records this right after that remark that he makes mention of the women that were present there, and particularly these four that stood at the feet of the cross. And here we have Mary, the mother of Jesus. You have Mary's sister. You have Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So three Marys and then Mary's sister. Some have conjectured or tried to make connections here. They believe that this may have been, whether it's Salome or Salome or the wife of Zebedee, which was the mother of James and John, which the interesting connection then John would have been the first cousin of Jesus, if that's so.
Right.
It would help us to explain, I think, to some degree, why he would help entrust this care to John and why maybe they were so close, this great love. At any rate, I don't know that we can say that for certainty, but we know that Jesus had a great love and a care for John, and so it seems natural that this would be the one to whom he would entrust the care of his mother. And so, having looked at these women, he'll look at his mother, and with concern and care for his mother, entrust her unto John. And I think it shows a great deal of his love and his compassion for others. I think it also shows his responsibility as he looks here as the firstborn, making sure that his mother is well cared for. And some have said, well, what about Jesus' brothers? We don't know the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be, even as sometimes we look in our life, I don't want to think about the event in which I would die and have to leave the care of my young children to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But in that event that happens, I'm not as interested in making sure they're with physical family. Unfortunately, that's not always the best case.
Right.
I'm interested in who's going to be their best spiritual caregiver, and I wonder if that's not part of the case here, is that his brothers have rejected him, mm-hmm. Up to this point anyway, and he wants then to place the care of his mother into the hands of John. At any rate, he knows that she will be well cared for, so entrust that, and John does indeed fulfill that care there in verse 27. From that very hour, took her into his own home, mm-hmm. and entrusted her to his care.
And did you notice how he used the disciple?
Mm-hmm.
Was it? I'm stretching back a little bit now, but wasn't it at the final supper, the disciple whom he loved,
right.
or something? Words like that. So he identifies himself in this particular way, kind of, maybe suggests to me a type of humility or
mm-hmm.
The way that he does that I thought was right. Particularly interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so that that second interaction there on the cross. And then as we have to move along, let's look at verse 28 through 30, the completion of the time on the cross, 28 through 30.
After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, says, I thirst. Now there was set a vessel full of vinegar, and they filled a sponge with vinegar, and put it on a hyssop, and put it to his mouth. When Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, It is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up the ghost.
Having now taken care of his mother, he knows indeed it is done. This saying is remarked or noted as maybe the fifth saying from the cross. And I want you to keep in mind something we've seen throughout the book of John. John 4:34, by me 'tis to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. And time and time again, John notes how Jesus' mission was foremost in his mind, to do the will of his Father. And it's only when he reaches the cross that he can finally say, it is finished.
Mm.
I've done the will of my Father. It reminds us, number one, Jesus, as we said before, is still in control of what's happening. It's not that he has been taken and his life has been taken from him, but rather he's been going through here with his face set to this event. He's known everything is leading up to this, And so he has continued fulfilling the work of his Father just as he said that he would do. And so he would cry out how he thirsts. One can only imagine that he likely has not been provided with water or anything, maybe even all through the night. You have the physical exhaustion that you're already under. You have the sun coming up. It's going to be getting warmer in the day. And others have noted how with the scourging and everything that's going on, the physical pain he's under, he probably has a fever. is probably an understatement. And how thirsty sometimes we can get when we have a fever in our body. Mm. And so it would be natural for that. And here he's going to be provided with this sponge with vinegar on it. Whereas previously he rejected what was offered, he did take this, and possibly one even mentioned that it was to wet the mouth just enough for this final cry in verse 30 to say, "It is finished." Something I learned in preparation for this study, I'd never seen it or heard it as far as I know, but it's that idea of finished in verse 30. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce the original word, but it was remarked that this was a word that would been used, say, by the farmer, that when an animal was born into his herd and he found that it was perfectly formed, that it was faultless, without defect, that he would utter this cry, it is finished, it was good. He said it might be used by the artist. One that has completed his work, he stepped back, he'd admire it, he didn't see anything that needed to be corrected, there was no fault in it, nothing still more to improve on, that could cry out with this idea of it is finished. And so it's not just that it's over, it's not just that he's, if you will, surrendering, it's this cry, I've done it, I've completed the Father's work, it is good. And so that reminder, this isn't a cry of failure. It is a cry of success.
Accomplishment.
That he has finished, he has done, he has accomplished the Father's will.
For the joy that was set before him. It's hard to kind of swallow that in.
And has endured all of these things. And let us not forget, as we read these accounts, I hope we don't forget the physical suffering that he endured, but let us not forget either that he was doing it for us. And read that into it as well, that he has accomplished this for us. And so throughout the book of John, Jesus does not lose sight of his mission, does not lose sight of doing his Father's will. And so he was set on finishing to do the Father's will, and now he has completed doing the Father's will. And then he will yield up or give up the ghost. I think it's interesting even in that. Someone remarked, not that his head slumped in death, but that he bowed his head and gave up the ghost. It's the idea of, again, completion, a deliberate rest here, laying down his life of himself, John 10 and in verse 18. That yes, indeed, he was giving it. It was not taken away from him. And so he has now died upon the cross. And we'll see the concern here as we, let me pause. I haven't done too well about stopping. Chip, anything that you would add to that or thought?
Well, just in that last statement that you made, I noticed my little column reference here points to his prayer in John 17. And at verse 4, as he prays, he says, "I have glorified thee on earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do." And certainly we see that accomplishment again, that idea of finishing. And boy, you could preach a sermon there, bro. I mean, you could, you know, he had nailed the Old Testament to the cross. He had purchased the church. He had washed men's sins, the blood that, all this that comes into play here, he had accomplished so much. It's an amazing statement just to sit back and behold what actually he accomplished. Mm. And, of course, we can save that for another 3-hour conversation. Right. But
that's why I chuckle there as you say that and you begin listing out, you know, again, that's a statement we kind of fly by. But you stop and think about all that was accomplished and completed and what all that statement, you know, seems so simple.
Three words.
Three words in English, one word in the Greek, and utters that and gives up his life. When I chuckled there because I was thinking that could be a series of sermons there, there that you could go through just on the idea of it is finished, and that's certainly true. But let us go ahead then. Let's go with verse 31 through 37.
Okay. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the bodies should not remain upon the cross of the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was a high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Then came the soldiers and brake the legs of the first and of the other, which was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water. And he that saw it bare record, and his record is true. And he knoweth that he saith is true, that ye might believe. For these things were done, and the scripture should be fulfilled, a bone of him shall not be broken. And again another scripture saith, they shall look on him whom they pierced.
Ooh, our clock is getting away from us. I wish we could spend more time on that. But a few things that I would highlight. It's the idea of their hypocrisy. They are interested. You know, we want to do the right things by the Sabbath.
Right.
And so we've got to get these bodies down off the cross. They didn't want to be ceremonially defiled on the Sabbath, but they didn't mind committing murder.
Yeah.
You know, they just crawled out for this death. But now are so interested in being, again, ceremonial clean on the day of Sabbath. And so they're asking that these legs be broken. That would speed up this process of the death on the cross. It seems the two robbers were still alive. Their knees were crushed so that they, as I understand it, that prevented them from being able to gasp for that breath and would speed up their death. But they find Jesus has already died. Unless there be any question, his side is pierced, and out comes blood and water. Some have noted there's some medical reasoning here that when one suffers from a heart rupture, that the blood collects in that region and begins to separate into a bit of a bloody clot and a watery serum. And again, don't want to read too much into that, but it's very possible that that is an indication there that the actual cause that led up to his death, as you know, the heart's racing through all of this and everything that's going on the cross, that the heart actually ruptures. And, of course, I think we could probably go too far with that in looking at that idea of how great his love and the idea of the heart rupturing. I think what it really just shows us is there's no question here that he was dead. As he hung here upon the cross, and that work was indeed finished. And there were the witnesses to these things. And again, highlight verse 35. We saw it. We bear record. It's a true record. These are true witnesses. And all again, verse 36, fulfillment of the prophecy, fulfillment of scriptures, verse 36 and verse 37, that not even a bone of him was broken, even as the idea of the Passover lamb there, that no bone was to be broken, Exodus 12 and verse 13, that all of these things are being fulfilled in his life. But then in just a few moments we have left, let's go ahead with verse 38 through 42, the burial of Jesus.
And after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him leave. He came, therefore, and took the body of Jesus. And there came also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night, and brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pound weight, Then took they the body of Jesus and wound it in linen cloth, clothes with spices, and as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new sepulcher, wherein was never man yet laid. There laid they Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulcher was nigh at hand.
Okay, and we have these two that to some degree have been quiet disciples, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, two men who had sought out Jesus at various times. Joseph is noted as a rich man, Matthew 27, verse 57, a member of the Sanhedrin, Mark 15, verse 43, a good and righteous man that did not vote with the Sanhedrin to put Jesus to death in Luke 23, verse 50 through 51. And now he will come much more boldly to ask the body of Jesus. Nicodemus, who had come at night in John chapter 3, now comes as well. And these men are going to give of their time, of their money, maybe even of their position,
right,
to come and bury Jesus. And I think, Chip, you had a note there concerning another thing that I have read over, concerning the weight of these spices.
Yeah, the Roman pound is recorded here that it actually was 12 ounces, and so this is about 80 of our pounds, as I have before me. And so this mixture that would be made, you think about, you know, an 80-pound backpack. I mean, that'd be something to have, but to have your body covered in this 80 pounds of myrrh and aloes for the anointing of the body, and then wrapped it with this linen to keep it in place, you know, it makes the resurrection that much more amazing to us, especially to them who wrapped him, you know, to these two disciples. But it's an incredibly heavy weight is what you and I were talking about earlier.
Right. And again, a statement concerning his death that indeed, I mean, I often think, well, he was wrapped. Well, he was wrapped, but there was 80 pounds of spices wrapped up with him there that they were preparing his body for burial, that he was laid there in the garden. There were those witnesses that knew where he was. And here he's going to be laid in this new tomb. There's references there that we could think about that there was nothing here of a power of anybody else that was going to raise him from the dead. It was the power of God. But now we see that completed work as you see the death and the burial now of Jesus as we end here in John chapter 19. And the question that I'll end with from this chapter is, whose side would you be on? Are you going to be there with Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea and the woman at the feet of the cross, or are you going to align yourself with the Jews and with Pilate? What will you do with Jesus? And there Jesus finished his work, but the call is unto us. What will we do with Jesus? And unfortunately, that is our time. And so another rich, wonderful chapter that in many ways we've skimmed the surface of. But maybe whet your appetite to go and study these things a little deeper, and certainly hope that you will do so and continue with us, as fortunately the gospel account doesn't end there.
Right.
We still have chapter 20 and 21.
Tomorrow's the resurrection.
And get to look forward to that.
Yeah.
And so join in with Chip and Richard tomorrow as we look there in John chapter 20. And again, we hope that you have a great day.